From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Rick Carr.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the first of what's likely to be many legal challenges to the NSA spying program. On Tuesday, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights each filed civil lawsuits charging the government with violating the constitutional rights of a group of lawyers, academics, activists, and journalists. The plaintiffs can't prove that they were the targets of the secret surveillance, but insist that because of the type of people they routinely communicate with, they have good reason to believe they have been monitored. Meanwhile, a number of criminal defendants are asking if the NSA wiretapping has been wrongfully used against them. Constitutional law professor Jonathan Turley is among those who think the Bush administration severely overstepped its bounds with the NSA program and said as much in a Democratic congressional hearing on Friday. Turley is also involved in one of the prominent criminal cases I just mentioned. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk first about the ACLU lawsuit. The big question here seems to be, what gives these folks the standing to sue if they have no actual evidence that they were harmed by the NSA program?
Well, that is the threshold question for that suit. In order to bring a lawsuit, you have to show injury. And the most obviously injured parties are those people who are suspected of terrorism. That was the focus of the operation. The ACLU clearly did not want those types of plaintiffs. They went with groups like Greenpeace. But in doing that, they dramatically increased the chances that the suit could ultimately be dismissed on standing. And many of us were surprised that they went with this array of plaintiffs. The great problem in all these cases is that the government can play a certain tactical game. It can refuse to confirm or deny that someone was a target of the operation and then claim that your case is based purely on speculation. But the ACLU picked the most difficult way to bring a case like this one.
So you've taken the exact opposite route. You're representing a criminal defendant, a Virginia Islamic scholar named Ali al-Tamimi. Tell me about that case.
Well, Dr. al-Tamimi was a controversial case even before the NSA operation because it was a case involving what's called violent speech. He was convicted based on statements he made at a dinner party, a private dinner party, a few days after 9/11. And those comments that he gave regarding what Muslims should do after 9/11.
He said they should go abroad and take arms against the United States.
Well, that's what the government witnesses said, is that his statements involved in part a suggestion that they could go to places like Afghanistan. Now, the United States wasn't in Afghanistan at that point, but it was known that we well could invade Afghanistan. Ultimately, he was convicted of 10 counts based upon those statements and given a life sentence. Now, the trial judge herself said she thought that that sentence was wildly inappropriate and excessive, but that she had no choice under the sentencing laws. So what's at issue with Dr. al-Tamimi, put aside the NSA operation, is the question of free speech. To what extent can the government criminalize statements that you made, statements that are critical of the government itself or its policies?
And now explain how the NSA program figures into this. You're charging the government with failing to produce all examples of the intercepts they had of al-Tamimi, which they're required to do under law.
Well, the case of Dr. al-Tamimi may be unique in the sense that since it's a pure speech case, what he has been saying is vitally important to the case and to his defense. Dr. al-Tamimi insisted that the intercepts submitted by the government were wildly misleading, and he sought any intercepts that the government had because he insisted that he has repeatedly opposed violence and repeatedly called for moderation. What the government said here was, no, there's no further evidence. There's no other intercepts.
And you know, or you strongly suspect, that the secret NSA wiretapping affected al-Tamimi's case.
Most independent observers believe that Dr. Al-Tamimi was a very likely subject or target of the operation. He was involved in a great number of international calls to countries that were targeted by this operation, and the government has said that it suspected him, although it never really did show, connections to Al-Qaeda. If indeed, as many believe, Dr. Al-Tamimi was a target of the operation, it means that the government misled the trial court. It can withhold evidence. It can say, we don't believe this evidence should be allowed into trial. But it has to honestly answer the court when it's asked if there are other intercepts in the government's possession.
So he has a good case to show harm. On the other hand, he's a lot less sympathetic a figure than the ones who are listed in the ACLU case.
You know, many of our most important legal cases were brought by very unpopular people. That's the nature of the law. The government generally doesn't proceed against popular people.
You know, one of the reasons why we focus so much on the NSA spying program is because of the sorts of things that the ACLU's plaintiffs are suggesting, that there is a chilling effect. Do you think that that's a side issue here, that really the issue is simply equal protection under the law?
Well, I think it's an important issue. I mean, in defense of the ACLU, they make a very good point. The main concern that we've had historically is how government surveillance changes us as a society. I mean, to give you a very simple example, when I teach the subject to my students, I tell them during the break to go home and put an empty tape recorder on a table and just tell whoever they're talking to that this is an exercise and only they will listen to the tape. And see what happens. Even though you're the only one who will hear the tape, suddenly the person you talk to talks in complete sentences, becomes incredibly eloquent and precise. When you think you may be under some form of monitoring, it changes the way you do things. Now, for lawyers and for journalists, the absence of confidentiality is a denial of our very function. We can't do what we do as reporters or lawyers, if the government can, on its own discretion, intercept our communications.
All right. Jonathan Turley, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a professor at the George Washington Law School. He's representing Ali Al-Tamimi, who is appealing his life sentence for inciting his followers to violence.
Last February, acclaimed Turkish novelist Orhan Pamuk spoke with a Swiss newspaper reporter about topics that are taboo in Turkey. Pamuk said, quote, 30,000 Kurds were killed here, 1 million Armenians as well, and almost no one talks about it, so I do. Talking about it prompted Turkish authorities to formally charge Pamuk with the crime of insulting his country. He's scheduled to go on trial in a couple of weeks. European Union officials who are debating Turkey's application to join the group have decried the prosecution as an affront to freedom of expression. But perhaps those critics should have looked into their own law books before they cast those first stones. Washington, D.C. media lawyer Kevin Goldberg has been working for the repeal of so-called insult laws like Turkey's, and he joins us now. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, I understand that Turkey's not the only country with this kind of law on the books. Can you kind of step us through what countries around the world do have insult laws?
They exist in virtually every country of the world, even the major Western democracies of Europe. They may not use them, but they exist on the books. They exist in Africa and Asia, of course, and are used to a greater extent in many of the still totalitarian or dictatorial regimes there. But even France has this law on its books. Spain, in fact, is prosecuting a case right now using an insult law.
The laws in other countries, when we talk about Spain or France having these laws, are those like the Turkish law, laws that prohibit insulting the nation? Or are they laws that are more about protecting the reputation of public officials?
These laws vary from country to country. Some do just protect the public officials. Some may go a little farther and protect the government itself. Some may go so far as to protect everything, including national symbols like the flag or the state seal.
Why are these laws so widespread? Why are they on the books in so many countries?
In some countries, such as France or even the United Kingdom, they exist because they've existed for years and much in the same way that we have anachronistic laws such as adultery laws that just are never used but still haven't been repealed. In other countries, such as I noted in Africa, they're a holdover from the colonial days. When the French owned many of the lands that are now independent nations in Africa, they had these laws in place.
You mentioned that Spain is actually going after a couple of journalists right now. Can you tell us a little bit more about that case?
It involves a newspaper that is no longer actually being published, in Prensa, but the case is still being pursued against the editor, José Luis Gutiérrez. And the article actually was published 10 years ago and reported the seizure in one of the southern port cities of 5 tons of hashish that was inside a truck owned by a company that belonged to the Moroccan royal family, King Hassan II, who himself has now died. The article itself was confirmed as truthful. But what constituted the basis for the prosecution under the insult law was the headline, Hassan II Family Enterprise Linked to Drug Trafficking. The two lower courts that found the defendants guilty of having, quote, illegally disturbed His Majesty Hassan II's right to keep his honor, sentenced the defendant to a fine.
Do these laws require that, say, the family of King Hassan II go to the Spanish government and say, we've been defamed, please apply this law? Or do the Spanish authorities in this case have the right to just go ahead and apply it on their own?
The families don't have to specifically request prosecution, and that is what is most dangerous about these laws. They're applied in a haphazard manner. They're used to politically persecute opponents.
I want to ask a question about how this might affect journalists in the United States. We've certainly seen in some countries, regardless of the fact that, say, an American journalist has never even set foot in that country, that because that journalist's work is available over the internet in that country, that that journalist might be exposed to a libel prosecution. Is it possible that a United States journalist could actually be prosecuted under one of these laws in another country?
Yes, that is a very astute and frightening observation. The fact is that many people have not paid full attention to the questions of jurisdiction that have been arising and have been decided in many cases to say that if you publish something on the internet, you better be aware that your works will be read in other countries, in China, in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, and that you should be considering yourself as subject to that country's jurisdiction. You know, if I publish something here in the United States that offended the honor of the Saudi royal family, I better not set foot in Saudi Arabia in my lifetime.
Well, Kevin Goldberg, thanks very much for coming in and speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Kevin Goldberg is a lawyer who's working with the World Press Freedom Committee on that group's global campaign to eliminate so-called insult laws.
Coming up, did the press go overboard to appear impartial in the Abramoff case? And was it too partial on a kidnapping?
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Rick Carr. This week on Capitol Hill, both parties introduced new ethics proposals in response to former lobbyist Jack Abramoff's guilty plea on charges of mail fraud, conspiracy, and tax evasion. Democrats allege that the Abramoff affair is a Republican problem. Here's party chairman Howard Dean on CNN.
This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true.
But legislators from both sides of the aisle have either returned Abramoff-related campaign contributions or given them to charity. And so some reporters have been referring to the scandal as a bipartisan one. Here's ABC's Robin Roberts on Wednesday's Good Morning America.
Right. And also, Americans know it's not just Republicans taking money, but Democrats as well. You bring up Jack Abramoff, but a third of the money that his clients raised, a third of those contributions went to Democrats. So that's a significant amount of money.
Yet at the same time, the Washington Post was getting a blogful from Democrats who blasted the paper for characterizing the scandal in pretty much the same way. So what's a reporter to do? Check the facts, according to Massey Rich, the communications director for the nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. Rich says that as soon as the Abramoff scandal hit the radar, the campaign finance reporting group was on it.
We had gotten requests from the New York Times in particular to take a look at who Jack Abramoff had given money to, as well as who had gotten money from the Indian tribes for which he was lobbying. And so what we did with our database was take a look at any contribution that came from Jack Abramoff or his wife, Pamela, as well as any contribution from an Indian tribe for which he was lobbying during roughly the time when he was listed as their lobbyist. We put that information out on our website, opensecrets.org, after the New York Times used it for their story, and particularly once Abramoff entered his guilty plea on January 3rd, that set off a barrage of media inquiries about the information that we'd put out. The most popular question was, you know, so-and-so is my congressman. Did he receive money from Abramoff? And we were able to say that with great confidence. The next question was, well, my congressman got this money from these Indian tribes. Is that Abramoff money? And that's where the confusion began.
This is a fairly subtle point. It's not necessarily an easy thing to get across in short sentences or short paragraphs. How do you try to explain that to reporters?
Campaign finance is one of the more difficult kinds of stories that you can cover because you can't always fully connect the dots. So I spent a lot of time talking to reporters explaining that these contributions from Abramoff and from the tribes he worked for, we have to assume that those were perfectly legal contributions. We learned about them from the Federal Election Commission, so they were disclosed in what would appear to be a legal manner. And unless the investigation by the Department of Justice tells us otherwise, we have to assume that they were given in accordance with the law.
I want to ask the partisan question here. Abramoff spent most of his life tied very closely to the Republicans, involved with the college Republicans at relatively young age. Most news outlets, though, have been reporting that Abramoff money made its way into both Republican and Democratic hands. I want to get to the bottom of this right now. Did Abramoff's money or Abramoff's clients' money go to Democrats as well as Republicans?
If you're talking about money that came from Jack Abramoff's own pocket or from his wife, Pamela, then only Republicans receive that money according to our research. Now, if you include the Indian tribes who had hired Jack Abramoff as their lobbyist, they gave to Republicans and to Democrats. The overall picture is about $3.7 million. 70% or so of it went to Republicans and 30% or so went to Democrats.
The fact that some Democrats are giving money back, does that perhaps increase the likelihood that people in the media and in the public at large would see all of this money as tainted?
Well, certainly some Democrats who have chosen not to give money back have made that choice for that particular reason, that doing so just acknowledges that there's some sort of blemish on this money. And again, as far as we know, these were perfectly legal contributions. Let's be clear that the money has been given back, either refunded to the people who gave it or given away to charity for purely political reasons. Because come the heat of the campaign season, you can bet that opponents are going to be running ads where some sinister voice is going to be connecting them to Jack Abramoff.
What's your recommendation to a reporter who gets this sort of first wave of information, X dollars given to Congressperson Y, to look into whether there was a quid pro quo or whether maybe there was more of an appearance of impropriety in this particular case? I mean, if a reporter calls and says, I don't know a lot about this, where do I go next? What do you say?
The only people who really know the details surrounding a particular gift are the giver and the recipient. And in this Abramoff case, we've been telling that to reporters a lot. Listen, we don't know why this money was given at the time it was. We suggest you talk to the people who were involved. And in some cases, they have. And we've learned interesting things about the particular timing of gifts. Some gifts we were able to eliminate from our list, actually, because Abramoff wasn't working for the tribe at that point as their lobbyist. But you really have to spend some time digging. You have to go to a variety of sources to try and correlate these things because not everything is reported to the same organization. The Federal Election Commission doesn't collect everything. lobbying reports, for example, are filed with House and Senate offices. So you have to cross-check with that. A lot of this stuff is done on paper. It's not going to be a quick-hit story. Most likely, these were perfectly legitimate contributions. There's a fine line between a legal political contribution and a bribe, but it's that line that's going to keep members of Congress out of jail or maybe send some to jail.
Massey Rich, thanks very much for coming in.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Rick.
Massey Rich is the communications director for the Center for Responsive Politics. The group's website is opensecrets.org.
And now, a recent case in which reporters largely lived up to the old adage, once burned, twice shy. This time, when would-be arsonists tossed a match, instead of fanning the flames, reporters reached for the hose.
Today's worst person in the world.
Keith Olbermann on his MSNBC show Countdown put it more emphatically than most.
The winner is Brent Bozell. His Cybercast News Service is apparently trying to start another one of those swift boat vet hatchet jobs, this time against the Vietnam vet Congressman Jack Murtha of Pennsylvania. The, quote, CNS News, unquote, story is a rehash of 25 years of unproven allegations that Murtha, who volunteered to go to Vietnam and won two Purple Hearts there, didn't deserve them. In massaging those charges, Bozell's writers use the following words. Allege, alleging, apparently, appears, indicated, may, and reportedly. Brent Bozell of CNS News. Today's worst person in the world.
Like I said, emphatic. I mean, Osama's still out there. But nerves are still raw from when the last so-called swift boat incident occurred, the one that smeared Democratic candidate John Kerry during the 2004 election. An ad campaign launched by a GOP-connected group called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth labeled Kerry a liar and his Vietnam War decorations a sham. Cable news went wall to wall on the ads and the charges therein.
We begin this hour with a display of political showmanship, gamesmanship, brinksmanship. That's sure to keep the swift boat flap afloat for a few more days.
It was classic he said, she said coverage, and it gave the story traction, which in hindsight, most agree it didn't deserve. It would have been funny if it weren't so sad. Well, to The Daily Show, it was funny.
You've seen the records, haven't you? What's your opinion?
I'm sorry, my opinion? No, I don't have opinions. I'm a reporter, John. My job is to spend half the time repeating what one side says and half the time repeating the other. Little thing called objectivity. Might want to look it up someday.
According to the dictionary, it's judgment based on observable phenomena and uninfluenced by emotions or personal prejudices. The media applied The Daily Show's definition to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, but reporters do seem to be sticking with the dictionary when it comes to the Cybercast News Service assault on Murtha. There was a recent Washington Post piece that was slammed for the way it picked up the Cybercast news story, citing the attacks against Murtha without much examination of the attackers, who either carried old grudges or were explicitly partisan or were apparently dead. But for the most part, the news pages declined to spill much ink on the charges, while the op-ed pages took umbrage at yet another attempt to smear a veteran exercising the right to dissent. Maybe the story hasn't stuck because we're not in the midst of an election. That's when torrents of campaign money soaked and spread the mud hurled at Kerry and at Senator Max Cleland, maimed in Vietnam, and in 2000 at former prisoner of war John McCain. Or maybe that particular tactic has finally run its course. Maybe it's a little too obvious, or in its shabby treatment of former soldiers, a little too crude. We'll see next election season. For now, we'll just offer a provisional bon voyage to the little swift boat that couldn't.
And now for a few of your letters. And I guess I should be glad that I'm not usually here because it seems like last week you really messed up.
Yep.
First, a couple of flubs by Margot Jefferson in her discussion of movies in which the plot turns on racial passing. Andy Seiler of Washington, D.C. noted that, quote, your guest erroneously stated that a white actress always played the black character who was passing for white in that movie genre. Not true. In the original 1934 version of Imitation of Life, not the remake, which you dwelt on, black actress Freddie Washington played the part. And we got this from Patsy Moore of Clifton, Ohio, quote, I'm afraid the segment last week about films dealing with racial identity and the historical realities of the 70s was a little too off the cuff, i.e., most states did not have laws against interracial marriage in the 60s, basically less than half, and most of those fell during the 70s. Don't you guys do a fact check?
Michael Eisen of Northern California was one of several listeners who found fault with my interview with Jonathan Zittrain about how the architecture of the internet leaves it vulnerable to a devastating virus. Eisen writes, "As a computer professional, I find internet maven Jonathan Zittrain's rant severely lacking in technical expertise. First of all, the mechanics of viral contamination remain confined to email attachments and bugs residing in web pages. Secondly, effective firewall and antiviral protection are available for free or less than an annual subscription to one's local public radio station. Zittrain merely echoes the often discredited attempt to subject the internet and email transactions to government regulation, an effort that makes no more sense than regulating people's postal activity because there are such things as letter bombs."
Keep those corrections and comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
As I read this Friday afternoon, there's still no word from Jill Carroll, a freelancer working for the Christian Science Monitor, taken hostage in Iraq, though her hostage video played all week on cable news. She was abducted on January 7th, but her identity wasn't reported until the 9th, not because the press didn't know it, but because they'd been asked to keep it under wraps. For more than 48 hours, the U.S. press observed a near-complete embargo. Monitor managing editor Marshall Ingwersen said he was, quote, "heartened that the people were so willing to help us" with the blackout that he'd requested. But once it was over, many asked why the press had so willingly squelched a story. Media critic Mark Jerkowitz writes the Don't Quote Me column for the Boston Phoenix, and he says that despite reports of some newsroom debate, in this case, the editors who made the decision were of one mind.
News organizations are very hierarchical. Generally, when it comes to kind of these tough ethical quandaries, no one goes out into the middle of the newsroom and holds a referendum and has a debate. Usually it's top officials, the guys making the most money, on whose shoulders these decisions fall, and they tend to be pretty decisive.
And some papers, like USA Today, who'd missed the initial embargo, even pulled the AP story from their websites once they heard from the Monitor. Does this kind of agreement surprise you? Does it worry you?
It doesn't surprise me as much as people think. First of all, not everybody did agree to it. There were some overseas news organizations initially that did not agree. I think that media organizations tend to be a lot more thoughtful when it comes to issues of life and limb than the public often give us credit for. I'll give you some examples in the area of national security. Right before the attack began in Afghanistan after September 11, 2001, Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post reported that 17 news organizations actually knew ahead of time when the bombing was going to start. That was embargoed. Knight Ritter sat on a story that the United States government asked it to sit on about special troops being on the ground in Afghanistan before the war.
The American media withhold a lot of stories for a time for a variety of reasons, and the public doesn't necessarily know. Famously, in the NSA spying case, they know the story was held for a year, and they've raised a number of questions about that. What about this charge that reporters were unduly protecting their own, offering preferential treatment to a journalist that they wouldn't offer a military contractor?
That's a troubling charge on its face. And I think if you're a real student of the media, you can make a case sometimes we treat ourselves and our own profession differently than we treat others. I think for one thing, media's coverage of layoffs, cutbacks, buyouts, and the travail in their own industry tends to be more excessive than it is when we cover other industries and other people who lose their jobs, for example. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that decision makers in newsrooms said, you know what, she's a journalist. We treat her differently than we treat a contractor or a civilian or anybody else who gets caught up in this. It's a little hard to make an analogous situation with kidnappings in Iraq, per se, because as a lot of journalists pointed out, two things. We don't know initially when a lot of people are kidnapped. And two, it is true that the Christian Science Monitor, because it's a media organization, had a way of communicating instantly with other media organizations. The families or employers of contractors, for example, might not have that kind of an opportunity. You know, some people have talked now in light of the Carroll case of coming up with a hard and fast policy about how to deal with these kind of requests. I think that's a huge mistake.
Yeah, you think it's better if the media are inconsistent, right?
You know, I like to see different media organizations make different decisions when they're confronted with the sort of the same ethical quandary. The public kind of thinks we're monolithic, that the news of the day comes down every day at 3 p.m. like the tablets from Mount Sinai. It's important to let the public know that editors and producers make difficult decisions based on different values and come to different conclusions about how to handle something and can justify it internally.
Okay, I'll buy that inconsistency can help the reputation of the news business, but will it help save the life of a kidnapped victim, and should we even be worried about that?
All you can do at that point is listen to a request from, in this case, the Christian Science Monitor, and decide out of respect for them and their concern about the safety of somebody that it's worth adhering to for a brief period of time.
I was thinking of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped and ultimately murdered in Pakistan. There were requests made to the media on how to report on him while there was still some hope of obtaining his release. You know, for instance, that they omit references to him being Jewish. How much discretion is just enough and how much is too much?
You know, rarely is there a rule book that says, okay, if it involves withholding a name, we can do it for 24 hours. If it involves withholding a religion, we can do it for 72 hours. Certainly, there can't be a double standard because they happen to be in the same business we are. If a contractor was kidnapped tomorrow under the same circumstances, then I would certainly hope that the decisions made would be based on the same basic humanitarian impulses that they were made this time.
You know, Carol is obviously not alone in being kidnapped in Iraq. It's become alarmingly common and obviously not just for journalists. But do you think her case provides a chance to have a public conversation about how the media should respond when journalists become part of the story?
The one thing that I think is important in any kind of public conversation is transparency. Explain to the public that there was an embargo, who was responsible for asking for the embargo, and the reasoning behind the decision not to break the embargo for 48 hours. One would hope that whenever we become part of the story, we are willing to talk about that candidly with the people who consume the news and who rely on us to do so.
Mark, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Mark Jerkowitz writes the Don't Quote Me column for the Boston Phoenix.
Coming up, the art of the sell, from health cures to the hard stuff. And at the ripe old age of one, the new food pyramid needs repair.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Rick Carr. Kevin Trudeau's was a familiar face on late-night television. Over the years, his infomercials sold products promising everything from a better memory to the cure for cancer. That is, until 2004, when he settled a lawsuit with the Federal Trade Commission. He was barred from selling any commercial product, and they fined him $2 million. So Trudeau did the only thing the government would let him. He released a book called Natural Cures They Don't Want You to Know About. And now, yet again, Trudeau is in trouble with the law, as OTM's Sebastian Kruger reports.
Call now for Kevin Trudeau's best-selling Natural Cures book, It comes with a full, unconditional 30-day money-back guarantee.
Last year, Kevin Trudeau's book took the publishing world by surprise. Released by Trudeau's own publishing company, the nonfiction book has sold 4 million copies and topped the New York Times bestseller list 9 weeks running. Trudeau explains.
There are natural, non-drug and non-surgical ways to cure and prevent virtually every disease. The drug companies do not want people to know about them because it will cost them too much money.
One of Trudeau's 4 million readers is Kevin Harville. A web developer and college professor in California, he saw the book at Costco. Why did he buy it?
Well, a general interest in taking better care of myself, of course, and somewhat a disillusionment in the medical industry, which operates like a fast food restaurant. You know, if you've got a number one, then you're set. Just say, I need a number one with Valium or something.
It seems Trudeau has struck a chord with many Americans' dissatisfaction with modern medicine. Dr. Beth Ann McLaughlin is a scientist with Vanderbilt University's Kennedy Center for Research on Human Development. She learned of the book through the family of an autistic girl she was treating. They thought it might help them in ways the medical establishment could not.
I believe that the problem that is underlying the Trudeau phenomena is one of communication, and that we're simply not doing a good enough job as clinicians and scientists of providing information that can be easily understood by our patients and their families.
On the other hand, Trudeau is a master of communication. In high school, his skills earned him close to $1 million running a mail-order business, and he tried his hand at Amway. By the mid-90s, he claims he was worth about $200 million, building his fortune through clever marketing of healthcare and memory-enhancing products. But Trudeau's practices haven't always been on the level. He's been a frequent defendant with a penchant for out-of-court settlement. In 91, he defrauded credit card holders of nearly $123,000, spending nearly 2 years in prison.
Early on in my career, it was about the money. I was on a fast track to make money. I cut corners. I made a mistake. And I paid the price. And since then, that was over almost 20 years ago. Martha Stewart, she made a mistake in her 60s. She was a billionaire. She should have known better. I was 20 when I bounced a check.
Trudeau was actually 28 at the time of his imprisonment, but he says he learned his lesson and that his mission changed to helping people. The Federal Trade Commission felt otherwise. Trudeau settled 2 lawsuits with the FTC, first in the early 90s and again in 2004, this time over a product called Coral Calcium. He was subsequently barred from selling or advertising any product. FTC attorney Heather Hipsley led the charge against Trudeau.
We banned Mr. Trudeau from using infomercials because of his recidivist nature, the fact that this was our second time around with him, and also because he had had previous run-ins with state authorities on consumer protection problems as well.
Unable to market products, Trudeau turned to selling his opinion. Because of free speech protections, the FTC didn't ban Trudeau from publishing, and so he released the Natural Cures book early last year. Most doctors agree with a few of Trudeau's healthy living propositions, eating right, exercise, reducing stress, but then things get weirder. Although Trudeau admits he's not a trained medical professional, he suggests an array of home treatments, everything from 15 enemas in 30 days to taking up Scientology, to staring into the sun to prevent hunger, to quitting all prescription drugs. Even a satisfied reader like Harville has his reservations about some assertions.
He said something along the lines of, AIDS not actually existing, and don't wear sunscreen. You know, go out in the sun and don't worry about sunscreen.
And Trudeau makes bold claims about the curative power of hydrogen peroxide.
Hydrogen peroxide intravenous cures cancer 90% of the time. Viruses go away, herpes goes away, hep C goes away. This should be front page news. Guess what? Hydrogen peroxide costs like $1.50. You can't patent it, nobody wants to hear about it.
Books like this make it harder for us to do our job.
Dr. David Raichel is the director of the University of Wisconsin's Integrative Medicine Program. His job is to bridge the gap between alternative and standard medicines. Despite Dr. Raichel's criticism, he does acknowledge that Trudeau has tapped into a real public health concern about money.
That industry is based on an economic model where the more people who have that disease, the more product that they will sell. Unfortunately, that has gotten so strong from an economic standpoint that has overpowered, if you will, the importance of looking at the complexity of how the body heals.
Trudeau also sees business interests infecting government as well. When the New York Consumer Protection Board began asking TV stations to reconsider running the Natural Cures infomercials last summer, Trudeau sued. The trial is set to begin later this year. Board Chairwoman Teresa Santiago argues that the infomercials and the book made promises they didn't deliver. Trudeau disagrees.
This Santiago is an idiot. That's why we're suing her, and that's why we're going to win, and we're going to show. This is nothing more than First Amendment suppression.
Although the board in Santiago would not comment for this piece, Columbia law professor Michael Dorff thinks Trudeau has a point.
Historically, the fraud exception to freedom of speech has been reserved for things other than publications.
So why would this agency take the unusual step of confronting a book? Trudeau believes it's because of the criticism he's leveled at business and the government.
Its main point, he says, is to expose a conspiracy among government regulators, pharmaceutical companies, the health industry in general, and this is a profoundly political point, so that targeting his book under the guise of targeting fraud is really about suppressing political speech. And to my knowledge, there haven't been a lot of cases about this, certainly none at the Supreme Court. The courts will have to sort out what standard of review to apply where you have a book that makes both factual claims and political claims.
In targeting the Natural Cures book, the government risks muffling the marketplace of ideas. But if Trudeau prevails in court, there's a different risk. Dorff explains that nefarious marketers who may fear being charged with fraud
will have an incentive to package those as part of a larger product that makes a claim about politics.
Regardless of the outcome, Dorff reminds us that by simply bringing this lawsuit, Trudeau may actually be doing an important service for our legal system.
It's often the case that free speech heroes are people who are making claims that are either false or not believed by the vast majority of the public.
Let's talk about what the 25 million customers that have bought my stuff over the years, let's see what they say. They love me.
Clearly for Trudeau, the naysayers have never been important. Free speech victory or not, he's already firmly convinced of his own heroism. For On the Media, I'm Sebastian Kruger.
From natural cures to the water of life, Absolut Vodka's rise from obscurity to the top of the premium vodka category it essentially created is a case study in effective advertising. Its 25-year print campaign was simple, centered on the shape of the bottle, and memorable, if occasionally inscrutable. But this week, Absolut dropped the campaign. The brand launched its first television ad, which features images such as the Absolut Road Trip, which is an Apollo moon landing to the rest of us, and only one shot of the iconic bottle. Richard Lewis spent years at the ad agency TBWA Shiat Day supervising the Absolut account. He's also written two books on the campaign, Absolut Book and Absolut Sequel. Richard, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So here's a brand that back in 1979, when it first entered the U.S. market, it was nearly unknown. It wasn't even all that
popular. It wasn't nearly unknown. It was entirely unknown.
And my understanding is it wasn't even all that popular in country of Sweden, as it says on the label.
No, actually, it was a product that had been around Sweden for over 100 years, but they weren't doing enough business to merit its continuation. So they really had a pump up the export, and the United States being a rich country and a country with a lot of vodka drinkers seemed like a great place to go.
Okay, so by the early 1990s, sales of Absolut had increased about 150-fold, according to some research that we did. Is that all down to the advertising? What was it about this campaign that worked?
Well, I think everything about the campaign worked, because what the advertising managed to do was sort of become a cultural marker. So, for instance, when Andy Warhol anointed, in a manner of speaking, Keith Haring to do the next Absolut artist ad, there was also an unveiling of the piece of art at the Whitney. So there was a big event which attracted the press that helped make the brand, you know, more well-known. What was unusual is that artists flocked to the campaign to help make themselves famous. What I call reverse borrowed interest. There was an artist pretty well known now who will tell you that Absolut really launched him. His name is Romero Brito. He lives in Florida, born in Brazil, and he's a real character. And it was Absolute that put Brito on the map.
That old campaign did have this iconic status. I mean, I think about college dorm rooms in the 80s or 90s where you'd see a lot of the ads on the walls of students' rooms. Was that part of the aim, to get people to almost like start collecting these ads?
You can't create a campaign and say, okay, we're going to make these ads collectible. That is never going to work. But because they look so darn good, people would want to hang them up on their walls. In fact, it even showed up in an episode of The Sopranos, because when Meadow went to Columbia, you know, she decorated her dorm room with Absolute ads.
Do you remember offhand which ads Meadow Soprano had on the walls of her room?
Oh, Rick, she must have had 60 ads up on the wall. And I suspect, you know, Meadow didn't hand pick them, but clearly in the late 80s and the early to mid-90s, there was a craze about it, deservedly so, because I think it's going to be remembered as, if not the greatest, certainly right up there, print advertising campaigns ever. You know, even Advertising Age, when it ranked the best campaigns of the 20th century, noted that Absolute, which was ranked number 7 in the 100 best campaigns, was the only one to do it without TV. Print actually works. People do read magazines. Imagine that.
By law, vodka has to be tasteless, colorless, and odorless. I mean, vodka is pretty much vodka, right? So as an advertiser, how do you define Absolute as something that's different? Is it the cool factor of these cultural associations?
I think people, first of all, become convinced that the vodka tastes different. Grey Goose has become a very successful brand on a taste platform. Can I identify one vodka or another after a blind taste test? Not at all. Jorn Lundquist, who was the president of Absolute, had a great line. He said, people are drinking the ads as much as they're drinking the vodka. And I think Absolute tasted better because of the advertising.
Richard, thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Richard Lewis is an alum of the ad agency TBWA Chiat Day, and he's the author of Absolute Book and Absolute Sequel.
We move next to another enduring icon, the food pyramid. It was redesigned and relaunched last April, but just this week, the Department of Agriculture said it will be slightly altered again to reflect mercury warnings about fish. But you probably won't notice unless you go to the department's website, because the new design basically consists of vertical stripes without words or pictures. Jeffrey Schaefer of the Christian Science Monitor wrote that to him, quote, it looks like the kind of undecipherable road sign drivers might encounter while motoring in one of the former Soviet republics. Last April, we spoke to Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition and public health at New York University, about the pyramid. Here's a piece of that.
You know, I'm kind of interested in the pyramid as a very important piece of American iconography. It dates back to 1992, but...
Actually, it dates back to 1991, which is when the Department of Agriculture first tried to release it and was forced to withdraw it under pressure from the cattlemen's associations and the dairy lobbying groups because they didn't like where their food ended up at the top of the pyramid. So in this version, they've gotten rid of that problem. There isn't anything at the top of the pyramid. I guess you're supposed to figure out where it went. One of the interesting things about it, from my standpoint, is that Porter Novelli, the public relations firm that developed this, had done an earlier version in which there was clear hierarchy. It had whole wheat bread at the bottom and Cinnabons at the top. And all of the eat less messages have been gotten rid of. So there isn't anything that you can't eat.
This pyramid doesn't tell you anywhere to eat less. And you mentioned Porter Novelli, this public relations group. Other departments of Porter Novelli represent various food industry clients with a lot at stake in the development of this pyramid. Should we be at all concerned about this?
Well, we should, because conflict of interest is just rife in this entire process. It isn't only that Porter Novelli has conflict of interest, but the Department of Agriculture has conflict of interest. And this conflict has gone back many, many years. On the one hand, the department's main function is to promote consumption of American agricultural products, and for that, the USDA must ask people to eat more, not less. At the same time, the department is supposed to be the lead agency for advising the public about diet and health. This sometimes means eat less. It certainly should mean eat less junk food.
And it doesn't even say that.
It can't say that. It gets into too much political trouble.
And so your feeling is that this pyramid, this has been a multi-million dollar, is it too strong to say, disaster?
Well, I don't know whether it's a disaster. I just don't think it's helpful. I mean, if you want to help the American people at a time when people are so overweight, you want an educational campaign focused on eating less. And to do that, you have to restrict portion size. Everything should be about portion size these days.
How do you visually depict eating less?
Well, I'm not a graphic designer, but if somebody gave me $2.5 million, I bet I could find somebody who could do it.
Marion, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Marion Nessel is professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. And now this perspective from Marilyn Manson.
The ancient pharaohs were not too bright, they say. But they made one contribution that I live by to this day. It's the food pyramid, and it's approved by the USDA. Whole grains are the foundation, so please take my advice. Have 5 to 11 servings of bread, cereal, or rice. 3 to 5 of vegetables, and 4 fruits is best. Their antioxidants and fiber help you to digest. 3 servings of yogurt, milk, and cheese. Help your bones and subsidize the cattle industries. A body needs to grow, and growing takes routines. That's why meat can be a tasty treat like fish or human beings. When you eat your sweets, make sure you try to limit your servings or you'll die!
Everybody!
My body is a pyramid that's made of healthy. What we say, yeah. Eat right every day.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and editorial help from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. This is On the Media from WNYC. Bob will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Rick Carr.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.